think we're back in touch with Mars, or in this case, Euston Road in Kent.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, it's already been said a couple of times today that sociology and the sociology of education has neglected space and spatiality. And there are, of course, some important exceptions, such as John Urry's work on the sociology of space and a handful of educational studies that pay attention explicitly to space and place. But by and large, sociological inquiry in education has involved asking those questions about social production and reproduction, power and equality and inequality, and in so doing, treating space and time as invisible and unproblematic containers, really, for social relations and material effects. And this neglect sits very uneasily alongside the rapid, if not manic, spatial developments that have been taking place in education in Western countries in the last decade. We've seen these extensive building and modernisation programmes that are leaving relatively few schools and universities untouched. And this activity has been accompanied by scholarship around the relationship between these kind of spatial developments and the changing political and economic landscape, and new, or in most cases old, but reinvented pedagogies. However, despite this scholarship, this literature, the dramatic changes in our built environment have not been accompanied, apart from these notable rare exceptions, by sociological engagement or critique, despite the fact that, as Mike has pointed out, many academic staff and academic managers are involved in the processes of spatial design and development. And I think this neglect partly stems from the lack of a strong field of spatial sociology in which to locate this kind of critical engagement. But it's almost certainly also because our own academic environments, whether that be political, cultural, or material, are not subjected as seriously as they should be to our own critical gaze. And in this paper, I argue there's a really strong case to be made for putting the spatial at the heart of sociological theory and practice in relation to education. And in particular, for those of us whose research and pedagogic practice aspires to some kind of transformation, social transformation, then critical attention to the spatial is really productive and opens up new lines of flight, to go all Deleuze and Guattari. And in support of this argument, I'm going to touch on some rather eclectic examples of spatial projects that I've been working on over the past few years, and on which I'm trying, I think, to impose some sort of coherence. It's work in progress. And I'm particularly interested in the impact of space on the construction and the recognition of knowledge, or different types of knowledges. My theoretical resources are wide-ranging. I found the work of the French philosopher Jacques Rancière very useful in understanding the role of aesthetics in maintaining and disrupting dominant regimes of the visible and the audible. Who and what can be seen? Who and what can be heard? And I've also found good thinking tools from utopian studies, in particular ideas around dislocated and unsettling utopian spaces, as suggested by Foucault's concept of heterotopia, or Peter Crafdor's notion of ruinant utopias. And this idea of psycho-classrooms has come from the field of art, and in delineating the generative possibilities of psycho-classrooms, I draw on these creative spatial resources that are offered by pedagogic art practices, so art that's operating in a specifically pedagogical mode. And alongside these conceptual resources, I've also been influenced by this really lovely strand of research that's carried out by historians of education such as Kathy Burke and Ian Grosvenor. And they use visual methodologies in order to interrogate educational spaces, mostly schools in their case. And inspired by this literature, I've been working over the past year with a very small collaborative research team that consists of myself, three undergraduate students, and a postgrad student. And we've been interrogating the spaces and stories of the construction of higher education, so to link in with these points that have already been made about looking to the past before we go looking to the future, or at, perhaps at the same time as we look to the future. And we've been focusing mainly on our own institution, the University of Warwick, and I'm going to finish off today by talking a bit about the methodologies and findings and the spatialised output and, from that project. But first to the title. So what are psychoclassrooms, and why is or should teaching be a work of art? During the summer of 2008, I visited this exhibition at the Hayward Gallery in London called Psycho Buildings, Artist Take on Architecture. And the name of the exhibition had been taken from a book of photographs by a German artist, Martin Kippenberger, which present architectural sculptures which were in some way eccentric or idiosyncratic. And to quote the curator of the exhibition, they had the salutary power to disrupt our habitual impulse to comprehend and consume the spaces around us with a single glance. And my ideas coalesced around this notion of psycho-classrooms, which might be similarly powerful spaces to the kind of psycho-buildings that were on show in this exhibit. Powerful spaces that would enable, or perhaps even enforce, a kind of critical reflexivity, a queer double take, so disrupting our single glance. And there were several features of this Psycho Buildings exhibition which spoke directly to my work around classroom space. And the curator describes the work of the artists as being to reactivate the complexities of our relationship to space, to prompt us to re-examine our notions about the relationship between the individual and his or her surroundings. Often working against the grain of established architectural practices, the artists create habitat-like structures and architecturally inflected installations which invite us to consider how built spaces function as social, psychological, perceptual environments. And these immersive sculptures highlight the crucial role of physical experience in our aesthetic encounters, emphasising what must be experienced rather than just merely seen, and actively engaging each visitor as an adventurous participant in the work. And so psycho classrooms then aim to do something similar. They aim to do something similar to this. They refer to sites of dissonance and critique in and which through the potential of space to influence pedagogy can be realised. Psycho classrooms aim to disrupt these habitual impulses and relations of teaching and learning, and they invite adventurous participation within the space itself. And this kind of invitation presumes an equality of the intellectual capacities of those working within the space, and is accompanied by a willingness to allow uncertain outcomes. And the aesthetic and material design and usage of such spaces works to disrupt and to redistribute what forms of knowledge may be sayable, audible, visible, and doable. For example, psychoclassrooms should enable the generation and the deployment of embodied knowledges and emotional knowledges. They should enable us to think about the social and the political function of the educational environment, as well as the ways in which space helps to constitute us as individuals and as groups and the relations as we interact within them. And in this way, teaching and learning that takes place within psycho-classrooms can be reconsidered as an aesthetic encounter, as aesthetic encounters. And here is where I draw on the work of Jacques Rancière and his understanding of aesthetics as a regime for the reconfiguration of sense perception. Put simply, what we see and what we hear and feel and say are routinely delimited by our location in geographical, political, social, and economic time and space. And to situate pedagogic relations and experiences in those kind of aesthetic terms is to draw attention to the ways in which teaching and learning both support hegemonic modes of sense perception and also have the potential, to use Rancière's own terminology, to redistribute the sensible, to reshape the different ways in which these sense perceptions operate. There's a very critical role for aesthetics in disturbing the dominant regimes of what's visible and what's audible, and making visible the kind of knowledges that so often remain invisible. And as such, the sensory and the aesthetic, I am arguing, should be the loci for our critical theory and practice. They're not something else that's out there that we might tag on as an added extra. They're actually absolutely central. Aesthetics and the sensory are absolutely central to the kind of questions that we're asking and the way that we need to be asking them. And Rancière calls for emancipatory pedagogic and artistic practices to enable a redistribution of roles and competences, as he puts it. And he exemplifies this through artists whose work assumes and addresses a spectator who, to quote Rancière, whose interpretive and emotional capacity is not only acknowledged but called upon. And Rancière has worked through this same point in an explicitly educational context when telling the story of the ignorant schoolmaster, the 19th century French professor Joseph Jacotot, whose own pedagogic experiment led to the discovery and proclamation of this theory that the equality, that there was an equality of intelligences between teacher and student. So put simply, that we assume that the people in our room, we assume the people that we're working with, the students that we're working with, there is an equality of intellectual capacity, and that has to be a starting point, and thinking about that spatially. And this redistribution of sense perception and roles and expectations is described by Rancière as dissensus, as a way of reconstructing the relationship between places and identities, spectators, spectacles and gazers, proximities and distances. And this idea of dissensus is also at the heart of a ruinous form of utopia. Such an approach is not against hope, but seeks to extend optimism into realms which are most commonly interpreted as pessimistic, anxious, or discomforting, to quote Peter Crafdell. Anxiety here serves quite a critical, useful function as being quite productive, a productive index of social contradiction, an emotion of the future. And ruinant utopias are committed to this kind of sense of incompletion, endless flux, process, critique, described by Peter Crafdell as an architecture of endless questioning, which seems like a kind of good architecture for us to be thinking about in the university context. The effects are contingent and affectual and more likely to be realised in the contemporary and the everyday moment rather than some sort of imagined future place of comfort. So there's a kind of source of optimism to be found in the ruins at the heart of this argument. And ruin, of course, is a familiar trope. For Bill Redding's, the university is in ruins, but rather than representing some sort of site of despair and loss, the concept of ruin suggests critique and reconstruction. And Patti Lather and other feminist post-structuralists have used the metaphor of ruins in very similar generative ways. And also useful for me, in much the same trajectory, has been Foucault's rather undeveloped notion of heterotopias or counterspaces. For Foucault, heterotopias are real spaces rather than utopias or fantasy spaces. And he describes heterotopias as having the curious capacity of being in relation with all the other sites, but in such a way as to suspect, neutralise, or invert the set of relationships that they happen to designate, mirror, or reflect. And Peter Johnson describes this. He describes heterotopias as not tied to a space that promotes any promise, any hope, or any primary form of resistance or liberation. Heterotopias are fundamentally disturbing places. He goes on, heterotopias draw us out of ourselves in peculiar ways. They display and inaugurate a difference and challenge the space in which we may feel at home. They don't fully function except in relation to each other, but their relationships clash and create further disturbing spatio-temporal units. We're much more used, especially within critical and feminist pedagogy, to regard classrooms as spaces of promise and spaces of hope, of liberation. And what I'm trying to suggest here is that it's actually productive for the work of critical and feminist educators to try and create and consider the potential for disturbing places and dislocations. Like ruinant utopias, heterotopias are dislocated from usual spaces. But importantly, they're not nowhere. They're not abstract spaces, and that's really, really important. They're localised. They're occupied. They're in a critical relation to their context. They're real. And although I suspect that what I've spoken about so far seems rather abstract, actually the work that I've been doing on space over the past few years has seemed rather relentlessly practical. And I am very committed to the praxis of identifying and creating psycho-classrooms and using such spaces to strengthen and develop our ways of thinking and talking about space, as well as, of course, of seeing what we can do within those spaces. So now I'm going to turn to look at some of those more practical things, and I hope that these theoretical ideas will make sense in relation to the practice. This is a Brazilian artist, Ernesto Neto's Stone Lip, Pepper Tits, Clove, Love, Fog, Frog installation from the Hayward Gallery's Psycho Buildings exhibit. And it'd be really nice to hold a seminar within this big pod-like structure. It's the size of a large meeting room. You could probably get about 15 people or so in it. And the walls are constructed from sort of wooden supports with transparent stretched lycra across them to make the walls. And in fact, there's an exhibition of his, just of his work, opening at the Hayward in June. So might well get the chance to do just that. And you enter into it through this oval aperture that you have to kind of step into. And then there's these sacks of spices that hang in the middle of the material ceiling. So in contrast to the traditional black or white box of the classroom, designed to close down any awareness of our bodies and the physical spaces that we occupy, Stone Lip, Pepper Tits, Clove, Love, Fog, Frog highlights an awareness of our multiple senses. You kind of walk in and all of your senses are activated by the space. And, of course, of our own structures of flesh and skin and bone as we stand or we sit in relation to this tactile structure. And thinking about how this haptic architectronics, as the curator calls it, might transform our classroom spaces is really productive, as is the opportunity it provides us for understanding the complex ways in which all spaces solicit visceral and emotional affects, not just spaces like this. You walk into a space like this and you're really aware of that. It makes you really, really conscious of it. But in fact, all spaces have that kind of effect. And the soft flooring in Neto's pod is seen as allowing a more fluid relationship between figure and ground than is usually allowed for in conventional built structures. And we see a similar fluidity in the use of the floor and the low-level furniture at the Reinvention Centre at Westwood that Mike talked about earlier, a classroom at the University of Warwick that was designed and developed in 2006 by Mike, myself and other colleagues and students. This classroom provides an open, challenging, aesthetically interesting space in which it's hoped some of the political and the pedagogical principles of research-based learning can be put into practice. And the classroom's housed in a unit together with a shop and a cafe. And this is quite an unusual location for a classroom, and it provides an initial sense of disjuncture. So passers-by quite often are sort of walking along and then they do this, they do the double take. And they ask, what's this room used for? And, you know, they poke their head around because it's interesting. So it's a space that clashes like heterotopias with the spaces around it. And at first glance, it certainly doesn't look like a university classroom. The rubberized floor is blue. The furniture consists of rubber blocks in bold colours. There are plastic lightweight benches in grey and black, yellow bean chairs, and a single replica Le Corbusier chaise longue. And all the furniture can be very easily moved about by teachers and students to create the layout that they want and they need. There are no desks or chairs in it, and no fixed technologies. And instead, there's wireless capability and multiple surfaces that can be projected on and used. And our intention was to design a room that there would be no top desk. Because when you're a teacher, what you normally do is you walk into a room and you don't even have to think about where you're going. Your body knows where you're going and you just kind of do it. And you put your stuff down and the students do the same. and the technologies of the room, the geographies of the room have established that dynamic, the dynamic of power, what's going to be said, where the knowledge is, where it's coming from. The locus of power and authority is in the geography of the room, and we wanted to disrupt that so that every time you walk into that space, you kind of stand there and you think, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to do it? And you have to make active decisions every single time you go in there. His decisions have to be made and remade by the students and the teachers according to each pedagogical situation. And the flexibility of the furniture combined with the heated rubber floor makes a range of different surfaces available and presents users with options that they don't normally have in conventional classrooms where the layout and the furniture orient them in particular ways. The proximities between people and objects in the room are kind of unfixed and up for negotiation. Students might cluster intimately on the large bean chairs, or they might occupy one in a kind of large sprawl. They might lie alone on the Le Corbusier chair or sit sideways, bunched up on it, to look at work closely together or with a teacher. And in this way, and echoing the ambitions of the Psycho Buildings installation, the room aims to disrupt the habitual impulses with which we understand and we occupy educational spaces. And in line with the principles of research-based learning, we wanted this classroom to be a space of construction where both students and teachers could be producers, could be collaborators of knowledge, of ideas. We wanted a space for setting and exploring problems rather than necessarily seeking the closure of answers or solutions. And rather than wishing to design a classroom for the 21st century or the future, a room which would be future-proofed, we aspire to create a space that would be open to the possibilities of the future as something to be made and remade, allowing for conditions of struggle and dissensus and ruin and failure. Now, it's not easy presenting designers and estates teams with a blueprint for a room based on the concept of ruin, although we did try. However, by thinking through the kind of sensory and the aesthetic dimensions of the space, we were able to translate a desire for a room that contained some sort of uncertainty and dissonance into practical decisions about lighting, about sound, about layout, about colour. So we were able to do that, to think about what these ideas meant in pedagogic and political terms to us, and then to translate them into aesthetic terms. And thinking about the relationship between those two things. We attempted what could be called, in Rancière's words, a redistribution of the sensible, of what could be sensed and sense perception, by organising aspects of the room so that normalising forms of visibility and normalising forms of embodiment might be disrupted. And as an experimental and thinking space, we've used the Reinvention Centre at Westwood in our work with local schools that are undertaking new design and building, as well as having school kids and teachers and their senior management groups coming in and doing teaching and research within the space and other spaces across campus. We go to work with them in their buildings. And we've collaborated as well with some local schools in decidedly psycho spaces, such as this secondary teaching and learning conference that was held in a local nightclub in Coventry. And this was the place they found to hold their conference and invited us to speak in it. And it, the darkness, there was all these mirrored and fractured surfaces, sticky floors, a not entirely pleasant smell, very strange furniture. And it kind of created the perfect disorienting effect for thinking about space, thinking about the pedagogic possibilities of kind of given spaces like this. And I was fascinated by the fact that the owners of a lot of these nightclubs are really keen to get things like education in during the day. They had it for free. The capacity's thousands on all these different floors because they're just empty spaces during the day. They're not used at all. And for our purposes, it was a really, really very interesting and productive space to work with, and we'd like to do a little bit more of that. So there's a kind of found psycho spaces here, you know, that we can really make use of. And of course, we've also made extensive use of the Reinvention Centre at Westwood within Warwick and across the HE sector. There's been some development of different types of spaces at Warwick and elsewhere. and some of the ones that Mike indeed has looked at through the Learning Landscape Project. And just to give you a kind of very banal example in a way, I'm a member of an advisory member of Warwick's refurb group. And they recently sent this email round. I'll just let you skim read it. So small victories, you know. I know this is hardly radical stuff, but I think enabling us to move between the political and pedagogical ideas around space into these pedestrian but important worlds of central timetabling and room refurbishment. And it reminded me of Leheran and Lewis, who are critical geographers writing in geography, critical pedagogues writing in geography, and they comment that valuing the room as fabric and experience is underestimated. Achieving difference comes from providing different conditions. We should not give up on tired infrastructure. And here was a picture of tired infrastructure that we found from some of our archival research. And it still looks just as tired. There's some whiteboards at the front, and that's about the only difference. So I'm going to go on now to run through some examples of my own recent work which bring research and teaching and learning together. These projects aim at making an intervention into pedagogic space in order to create psycho-classrooms or dislocated pedagogic spaces and bring about a redistribution of the sensible, and more conventionally perhaps to raise the profile of sociological research around questions of educational space. The first example is an interactive exhibition that I devised with Elizabeth Simberger entitled Sociologist Talking. And this drew on 22 in-depth interviews with sociologists from over the UK talking about the academy, the relationship between teaching and research, their identity as academics, the relationship between teachers and students. And it's a site-specific exhibition that we've devised and shown in two very different types of teaching spaces. Visitors are invited to interact with the text of the data via multiple sensory and participatory modes. So very different from sitting down and reading an article, even though the data is effectively the same. And these modes challenge the possibility, or were intended to challenge the possibility, of a dominant or a linear narrative, and they attempt to locate the participant as part of the process, as integral to the discussion that's taking place. Extracts of interviews were projected onto curtains, so they kind of floated around and you could read these fragments of them, and also written onto the glass. And themed interview data could be listened to on headphones, so kind of a private conversation, or in a more public area where there were some sofas. And the sociological texts that had informed the analysis, in particular Les Bach's Art of Listening, were displayed on plasma screens. And the participants were invited to leave their thoughts on whiteboards. This was the second time that we did so a similar exhibition using the same data, but we did it in a different site, which changed the kind of nature of what we did. And here staff and students were encouraged to engage with the space and the presentation and construction of knowledge within the space in an unusual and possibly quite dislocating way. And after visiting the first exhibit, Les Bach wrote an article for Sociological Research Online. And he commented that the Sociologist Talking exhibition offered the opportunity to eavesdrop on the conversations that we're all having with our colleagues, friends, and even ourselves about the state of academy. And he talked about how a commitment to dialogue is central, not least of all with our students, if we're to seek and to find new audiences and publics for sociological ideas. He says, we have no choice but to play the game and establish standing that can be quantitatively recognised. However, this is a dead game without retaining a commitment to communicate to a wider range of publics inside and outside university, including students, and people searching for alternative issues, ways to think about the issues of the day. And I think there's similar scope. What we learnt from both of these exhibits, which were hugely challenging to do and quite interesting, both in terms of the process of being able to do them and also the ways in which people interacted with them and responded to them, I think there's real scope for using similar kinds of media within the curriculum and devising interactive and open-ended forms of assessment that productively trouble the spaces of the university by using them in different ways for different ends. We turned our classrooms into works of art, and it made people engage with the kind of knowledge that we were producing in quite different ways. My final example is of the Spaces and Stories research project that I mentioned very briefly at the beginning, that involves a collaborative research team of myself, three undergraduate students in sociology and history. Two of them were first years when they started, and one was a second year, and also a sociology MA student. And we've been working together as a collaborative research team, which perhaps offers one example to your question earlier, Sarah, about how you engage undergraduates in these kinds of processes. And we're funded by the Higher Education Academy's History Subject Centre for a year. And that has enabled us to pay the students to work as researchers. And this is what we've been doing. Is there one before that? We've been asking what are the ideas and the ideals around higher education, the university and the university student, and how these ideas and ideals are constructed through the design and the building of our own university, the University of Warwick. We've been asking how these ideas and ideals come to matter through site-specific practices at and with built forms, and looking at how and in what ways these ideals are challenged. And comparing the 1960s, Warwick was first built in 1964, and so going back to the data from the 1960s right through to the present day, considering how these ideals have changed over time and seeing some of the kind of the continuities or the going round in circles, the revisiting of sort of old issues in the current day. We've undertaken archival research looking at correspondence, architects' drawings, committee meetings, press reports and so forth, from when the Warwick University was just a site of fields and Warwickshire hedgerows through to what we have now. And we've identified and interviewed key players in the spatial developments past and present, including academics, architects, administrators and management, local residents, and we've conducted in-depth interviews with them, quite often walking interviews, going around the university and looking at the buildings and using the landscape as a kind of trigger for the interview discussion, and also photo elicitation interviews. So we've been using the material from the archives, the lovely old photos, as a way of kind of triggering people's memories and getting them to talk about some of the spaces, which has been particularly interesting for us because a lot of the places we just couldn't recognise anymore. Some of the classrooms we could, and they did look exactly the same, and there was others that we thought, where were they? You know, what was going on there? Or who was that person in the photo? So that's been really nice, kind of using the story aspect to delve into that history. Here we are working on our analysis day, and the kind of data that we have is we have photographs and transcripts, we have documents, we have video footage and sound files, and we're going to show this in a research exhibition that will be open to the public in June this year. And our data highlights the significant impact of architecture and building and landscape on the identities and the relationships and hierarchies of the university. It shows the affectual and the material power of the built environment to generate kind of feelings of pride and belonging and inclusion and exclusion. Our curatorial ideas for how we're going to do the exhibit are still very much in process and are being developed with the help of the university's art curator. But we're being guided by the principles of pedagogic art and the idea of psycho-classrooms, seeking to create a space of productive and interesting dislocation and dissensus. We've got a great big pile of books on spatial theory and all the old university prospectuses that have been part of our data, and HE reports like the Robbins report that was so influential in generating universities like Warwick. And we're piling all of these books into a great big tower of learning, which is a nod to one of the original architectural plans for the university was this Tower of Learning that's later been described by one of our interviewees as a fantasy. You know, it never came to happen. In fact, Warwick, if any of you have ever been there, is a sort of flat modernist landscape. But in the original picture in the Times that announced that Warwick Coventry was to have a new university had this kind of great phallic spire that was going to be the Tower of Learning. So we're going to kind of recreate this with our theoretical resources, a kind of Tatlin's Tower that will probably fall down and be a health and safety nightmare. So there's these kind of things that we're doing alongside maps superimposed with people's stories of how they came to be. Local resident students, staff, estate staff, the university's architects, those who made decisions about the universities in the 1960s, and those who do now, will doubtless interact with the images in very, very different ways, the materials in very different ways, and hopefully will contribute more kinds of stories and ideas to it. So again, they're being included as an adventurous participant in the work, to use the phrase that the curator did from the Psycho Buildings. And the exhibit runs 28th of June to 2nd of July, and it'd be lovely to see you there if you'd like to come. So just to conclude then, all of these examples highlight the significance of the spatial and the aesthetic as a vital resource for sociologists of education to think about and with and consider in relation to their academic practice. And by academic practice, I absolutely mean their research and their pedagogical practice, their research and their teaching and learning practice. Like psycho buildings, psycho classrooms are not a symptom of disorder, but a welcome deviation from the rationalisation and the abstraction of space. And they may take myriad, they do take myriad different shapes and forms, as I hope that the kind of eclectic examples that I've shown demonstrates, but they deviate from the normal in that they pay attention to the aesthetic and that they work via dissensus towards a redistribution of what might be sayable and visible and doable within them. And this kind of redistribution has profound implications for the construction and the definition of different knowledges, as well as for the roles of teacher and student. So psychoclassrooms can become sites of antagonism in relation to the dominant ideologies of the neoliberal institutions in which they're embedded. And this kind of antagonism generates, in turn, spaces of potentiality. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Another inspirational paper. Could I invite questions, please, from the audience? And again, just introduce yourself before you pose your question.
I'm Vicky from Oxford. I was just wondering...
Could you speak up?
Just wondering, I think it was really, really interesting. But I wonder how much, like, and I really liked the, is it Ernesto?
Ernesto Nieto.
Yeah. His space. But I wonder how much of the kind of disruption comes from the surprise of it, and how do you keep creating surprise all the time?
No, it's a good question, because I think that, you know, our room, the Room Mentor Centre, also has some of the same impact. It's surprise.
Yeah.
But actually, it's not that difficult to create surprise.
Okay.
And I suppose because the type of classrooms that we're normally operating in are so unsurprising, it only takes a little thing to actually make them quite surprising. And so I don't think it's that difficult. I mean, you can do it in different ways in different spaces, but I'm not sure it has to be... Obviously, that's a dramatic example, you know, but I don't think you need to recreate an expensive tactile work of art in order to create surprise.
Right. Okay.
Thank you. Louise?
I really enjoyed that. So stimulating, exciting and wonderful. I have a question, though, about... It's a little bit like the 1960s. What purported to be disruptive was actually very reproductive and reinforcing dominant power relations.
Yeah.
And when I saw your classroom with all the low-level backless and whatever, the first thing that came to my mind was the norms around age and able-bodyism that were embedded in there. And your picture.
You're thinking, hold my back.
Yeah. And a lot of people I know would have been in agony participated in that. They simply, the knees, the hips, the backs, whatever.
Yeah.
And all the photos were young, they seemed able-bodied. There was a norm, an idealised student embedded in that construction. Yeah. So what was actually purporting to be disruptive could be seen in another way as intensely reproductive.
You're absolutely right, and we thought a lot about this, obviously.
Right. I don't have any original ideas either.
No, but to create a new space and to not do would be deeply problematic.
Yeah.
And I think, you're right in some ways, but in other ways, I think that space can be engaged with in lots of different ways. And of course, young people might be more likely to go and sit on the floor. You know, there's no doubt about that. But wheelchair users love that space because you can move in and around it without any of the usual clutter and trying to get round chairs and tables. So it's kind of more complex than that. And I would say that those kinds of issues around comfort and discomfort pertain to every single space, but we only ever ask them of the kind of unusual spaces. So there's many of the spaces that we work in are deeply uncomfortable for all kinds of reasons. They're too hot, they're too cold, they're too stuffy, there's not enough room to move about, things are uncomfortable, but we don't even think about it because they're normal, because they're normalised. And in creating something that is unusual, it then becomes more problematic, and we problematise it in it, and it can't be comfortable for everybody.
No, I understand that entirely. It's just that the claim of the unusual.
Yeah, it set it up in a certain way.
Yes, can actually reproduce a lot of body norms, pain-related norms.
Yeah. I think they do, and I don't think you can avoid that. I think you can be aware of it and you can be critical of it, but I don't think you can escape it. I don't think you can. How could you possibly have a room that is comfortable for everybody? And I take comfort in the wider sense, not just in terms of physical comfort, but what an unsettling room. What's unsettling for some people? Some people hate that room because it's just so open and frightening and it exposes you. And other people love it because it feels much more intimate and they feel at home in it, and they pull up the beanbag or they lie on the caboussier and they never felt more comfortable in their life. And those different responses are often coming from they are about embodiment, but they're about lots of different things as well. And so, we have been working quite a lot with this idea of comfort and discomfort. But, you're right.
Can I ask you about the layout of the room? Most people tend to be at floor level. Anybody sitting up high, do they take a more leadership role in the...
Well, you can't sit up high.
Sitting on a square.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Higher. Absolutely higher. Do they tend to dominate if they're sitting physically higher in the meeting?
No, because of the question of comfort and discomfort. And I think... the chaise longue is really interesting in terms of how people use that, because it's such an unusual piece of furniture that to occupy it is to kind of make a statement. And so even though you're kind of prone, which is not a powerful position from which to speak. And in fact, I was sitting, we had a research meeting in there a few weeks ago with some colleagues from King's College London, and someone was sitting in the beanbag, and they'd been happy in this beanbag quite a long time listening, and then they said something, and he said, actually, it's harder to speak from this beanbag than it is to listen. And I think it was just suddenly you became aware of a kind of lack of authority, of speaking from, it was quite enjoying sitting there. Yeah. So there are different things. There is something to do with relative power and the furniture, but I don't think it's as straightforward as being slightly higher. But it is true that you kind of probably have a little bit more sort of power by punching on a block than sitting on the floor.
Doing something new. So doing something anti-conventional and doing something new is actually in. it's part of a kind of logic. And you mentioned the word iconic building, technologically new. You know, if you haven't got a space like that, well then kind of you're sort of missing out. I wonder how disruptive that is, rather than just kind of, you know, actually it's about, we are in a very curious moment around universities.
Yeah.
And around in which the future is amorphous, and the future has no definition, and the future could be anything, even while conversely a whole lot of things are going on that are doing something quite rigid and controlled.
An excellent question. Cap first, and then Mike might want to respond, then to Diana.
Okay, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, I totally agree with you, and I think to some extent you have to play the game, because it's being able to speak those kinds of language and participate in those kind of discourses that you actually get to do things, you know. So getting the opportunity to create that space is by partly buying into some of those, you know, investments around a kind of fetishization of space, if anything, that's certainly going on, but then trying to critique that at the same time as you're doing it, and that can be an uncomfortable process, and sometimes it doesn't work, you know, and we have to kind of accept that possibility of failure, I think, in doing those things, and how disruptive it is. And in terms of like making claims for how disruptive it is, I think that's for the people who were in there in the moment to say. I mean, I think it does have disruptive potential, but that's not by virtue just of being there. That has to be realised in the ways in which it's that's about the pedagogy and the politics of how it's used and what's done with it. And to do disruptive teaching, you don't need that kind of a space, which in some ways is why I wanted to show you the given spaces of the, you know, of using the nightclubs and the more banal example from the central timetabling about messing around with the other spaces, that there are also multiple other ways in which, you know, you create different kinds of spaces of dissonance.
Thanks, Pam.
Yeah, well, I think you can't be radical enough, but there are limits to how radical you can be in any given moment. So what one does is one radicalizes the situation as far as one can in relation to the history of radicalism in the universe, or the history of progress, and what that has achieved, and recognize and remember and repeat that. And then once you won the victory, then you get more radical. So at the moment when people think that they kind of know what's happening and they've got some understanding of it, then you radicalize it again. And then you push it, push it, push it. And I think the future can't be anything. I think it can't be an end. I think we're always working in the limit of the conviction. And that's the conviction that gives us dynamic principle. And it's working within that principle that pushes us forward. And our inventions are always conflicted and are always contradictory. And they're always progressive, but they're always kind of reactionary as well. And we can't get out of that moment. So our spaces are both limiting and non-limiting. They're open and closed. We don't make the claim that it's open. It's not. It's completely closed and enclosed within the structure of the curriculum, the structure of the university. It's just a moment of critique. And it can never be the full moment. It can only ever be conflicted. So what we're trying to do is deconstruct ourselves and controversialise the issue, to make it an issue, to make it a controversial moment. Your classroom is controversial. What we did about it, it's flawed to the max, but it's got a utopian moment in it somewhere that we're trying to work towards. Now, if you don't like it, if you hate it, that's part of the point, but you then design your own classroom and move it on. If you don't think that's enough, and you can do it because we did it. And we could moan about it and say we hate the space, but we made it in the space. We found a way to do it. And you can. So don't tell me how overworked you are or what your workload is. I know all of that. Do something else about it. And then we can argue about your moment and we can try and move on. So it's not the end point. And it's not the beginning. And it is the 1960s. And that's what we want. We want to recapture the 1960s. Because we're still in the shockwave of it. And we want to get some of that energy and that back into the debate about imagining university.
Thanks very much, Mark. Diana's point?
I'm all in favour of recovering the 1960s, and I do think that in the sense of writing about them and exploring them and recording experience, so I think it's been a really interesting coming together of the different papers. But I did wonder, I mean, the management structure that we're now combating within the universities is
So, I mean, we have sofa government. My institution, we have sofa government of a small number of people who are making major decisions.
And then they're being on.
The star chamber.
We were at another conference where they were comparing universities nowadays to Italian city-states, where the princes actually believed that they were the university and the university was them, and they made the decision.
Yeah.
So all this involving of other people, I'm really in favour of it, but it takes amazing amounts of time. And for architects, it takes amazing amounts of time as well. Although there certainly are architectural practices who work on building schools for the future or work on new forms of healthcare design and so on. I never seem to come anywhere near them. So it's great that you managed to do it. And all strength to the rest of our arms in trying to do it. But the kind of particular structures that we're working with, the demands for efficiency and cost cutting and everything, there were so many interesting things, both in schools and in relation to the subject areas and the pedagogy and the new modes of assessment. For me, at the moment, I can think it's going to be most easy to try and write it historically rather than to reconstruct it now, because I think there will be enormous opposition to it. Of course, there wasn't in the 60s. I didn't like it then. I'm not going to like it now. And I think there are managerial structures which make them more efficient. I'm delighted you've got the riot police. I kind of feel I'm leaving the university more or less as a community.
I mean, it's a badge of honour, isn't it? We can market it.
It's a change of the dog you're on.
Badge of honour at University of Essex.
Yeah.
Were you there when you were
on? Exactly.
Anyway, sorry.
Can I ask Catherine to respond and then Mike?
Okay, really quickly. Of course you're right, but that's not an argument for doing nothing. It's a more of an argument for doing more. It has to be. It creates a more urgent situation in which there's more requirement. The looking to the past isn't an alternative. That's part of the same process. It's not impossible. It's absolutely not impossible.
Well, I agree it's not impossible, but I think the resistance will be sharp. That's no reason not doing it.
No.
Yeah. We don't want to fetishize the 1960s, but what we do want to hang on to is the critical moment that lies in the heart of what a university is. And the 1960s was just a particular dramatic expression. But if we lose that moment, or we lose the possibility of that moment, then we simply have no more universities. It simply ceases to exist. Whatever the management structure, or whatever it's called, it's simply not a university anymore. What we're really talking about is the meaning and purpose of higher education. And I think with regard to university management structures, I think that the structures are overwhelming, but there are some very progressive people in those structures. One of this group is now the Vice Chancellor of the University of Lincoln, where I am. So we have a very progressive academic at the heart of the institution, at the head of the institution. And it'll be extremely interesting to see how that all works out. So, it's not impossible to get into those positions and then have an effect. And I think, again, that's our responsibility, to put ourselves in those difficult positions and have some effect at that level. But that's another way of going about it. It's not just easy, overwhelming, but it has to be.
It involves changing who the community is that the university is responsible to, and getting away from the biz approach to universities.
Yeah. Well, the business approach is unsustainable wherever. We're trying to normalise it. It's collapsed. Neoliberalism has collapsed, and yet we're still operating on the model. So it's over already. So the really smart universities are already thinking about what's the new model.
Well, that seems a rather ideal space to post like that for us to munch on that over lunch. A fantastic morning. Thank you particularly to Kat, who's got the paper. Mm-hmm. We'll thank her again.
Thank you.
We adjourn now and we reconvene at 2:00. could I direct your attention to Polly, who's arrived, if you want to talk collaborations and knowledge transfer, as we are now obliged to say. And thank you for returning, and thank you very much for your contribution, especially to our speakers, Mike and Kat. Lunch is at the back.
Well, now,